You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. It's been a while since we returned to the subject of ufology. And who better to join me than our good friend Philip Mantle in his wonderful new book, UFO Landings UK. Philip brings us numerous cases from the 19th century right up to the modern era, and many have been overlooked for far too long. From 1963, two teenagers encounter a creature that bears a remarkable resemblance to a monster notably seen later that decade on the other side of the Atlantic. And beware, this case also provides one of the more ludicrous rational explanations ever put forward for a UFO witness encounter. We look at the series of weird events that occurred over the Warminster area in the 60s, which for several years became the UK's UFO hotspot. A case from South Yorkshire, an incident that terrifies a child so much she falls from her horse. A housewife whose case should be more famous than most, and we meet a member of the Air Force who has a strange encounter deep in the midst of World War II. It's remarkable that most of these cases are not more well known, and I congratulate Philip for bringing them together in this fantastic new collection. There will be many that will astound you. But as always, don't forget, you can support the show for signing up for Patreon for $4 a month. You can click on the link in the show notes, or go directly to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. Early access, ad-free episodes, and bonus content. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. As always, you can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, links, and merchandise. As always, a big thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's discover, together, some UK-based UFO encounters that you've never heard of, and when you've heard them, you'll wonder why.
It's been too long since my guest this week last appeared on Mysteries and Monsters, but I'm delighted to welcome back ufologist, author, and publisher, Philip Mantle. In his latest book, UFO Landings UK, Philip brings us a collection of encounters from around the United Kingdom that involve landing incidents. It seems that strange things were visiting these shores long before Kenneth Arnold had his sighting in 1947. Philip, welcome back.
Yeah, good afternoon, Paul. Nice to speak to you, my friend.
As always, a pleasure, Philip, a pleasure. As someone that's got to know your work a lot, and as someone that's kindly being on the show a couple of times, Philip, when I saw that this latest book was coming along down the pipeline, I was deeply interested because the more I've done this show, the more I realise how little I knew about a lot of subjects, Philip. And I know when we've spoken previously, we've touched on some cases and some of the work that you've done, but I'm delighted to see we seem to have a really comprehensive collection of some of these incredible encounters through the UK's history that, as I said on the introduction, clearly there's been strange things going on for a long time. So for you, when you decided to kind of pull these cases together, Philip, did you think that this was one of those books that needed to be written because it's been sorely lacking in sort of an overview of the ufology history in the UK?
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, no disrespect to any of my colleagues, wherever they are in the world, but the subject tends to be based mainly in the United States for obvious reasons. There's been a lot happening there. But we have to remind ourselves that whatever the UFO phenomena is, it's international in scope. It knows no national, it recognizes no national boundaries or international boundaries. And that things, despite what the debunkers might say, Paul, they would have us all believe that it's some drunken hillbilly in the New Mexico desert that sees these things. That's not the case. These encounters, whatever they may or may not be, you know, happen here in the UK and, you know, literally on our doorstep. And most UFO researchers, I would guess, will not know of these cases that are featured in my book. So I thought it would be a valuable tool, if nothing else, to be made available. And that was one of the things that was behind it.
As someone that considers himself quite well read in regards to certain subjects, Philip, I'm amazed at the amount of cases in this book that I wasn't aware of, or I only had a very minimal knowledge of. And there are some cases when I've read the book, and I've had to read it twice, Philip, to take it all in so far. So I'm sure I'll be reading it again, because it's fascinating that there are some cases, especially from the 60s and 70s that happened here in the UK, that are so well reported. The witnesses seem entirely sincere and grounded, normal people, as you said. These are not stupid people or people wandering home from the pub or whatever. These are normal people from a variety of backgrounds. And I was blown away by some cases, because I just cannot comprehend that when we talk about UK cases, Philip, and you may disagree, it seems that we tend to sort of focus on about three or four. Obviously, there's the infamous Rendlesham, and I think that's all we'll say about that case. We've got Alan Godfrey, and obviously the work that Malcolm did in regards to the Deckmont incident up in Scotland. And I think after that, people really begin to struggle. And I know recently it's been quite interesting that everything that happened in Wales in 1977 around the Broadhaven area seems to really have gathered some traction as well, Philip. So do you think that it's just one of those things that, once again, as with any kind of situation, people tend to focus on these more well-known cases to the detriment of some of these, what you would say, are probably as good, if not better?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the only one I cover of those three is the Livingston case. Because, you know, I met Robert Taylor.
Yep.
I went with my colleague Malcolm Robinson to interview Mr. Taylor. But I purposely left out Rendlesham because, you know, there's whole books have been written about that.
Yep.
But I think it's the same in any country, Paul. They tend to focus on a handful of primary cases. And the rest are left by the wayside. And you know, for example, now it's everything is the Tic Tacs and the Navy videos. And I'm sick to death of seeing those damn pictures because they are the go-to pictures of UFOs now.
Yeah.
And like I say, other things tend to get left behind. So again, it's another reason for writing a book like this, just to say, just don't forget, yes, these cases that probably are the primary ones, you know, they are important, but don't ignore everything else that's gone before or after it, because it is all part of the puzzle. They are all significant in one way or another. And this book has been in the planning for many years, Paul, and it finally got to the stage where I wrote it during lockdown. And I just want to explain something. If someone goes onto Amazon to buy it, it will see the publication date of 2020. That was the original publication date, and I'm just not able to change it. But it wasn't published then because COVID came along. We were also making a documentary based on the book. We got half of that made, but the idea was to bring the book and the documentary out at the same time. But COVID stopped us making the rest. However, that should be finished this year.
Mm.
So I thought, well, I can't wait any longer. I'll just push the button and put it on sale and keep my fingers crossed, you know. And so there's a number of reasons, you know, why things happened the way it did. And you're right in saying, Paul, one of the things I've tried to emphasize in this book on one of my previous books called Without Consent, that dealt with abduction cases in the UK and the UK only.
Mm.
It's also to emphasize that the people who have these encounters and experiences, just like you and I, mate, it could be your next door neighbor, could be your colleague at work, they wouldn't stand out in a crowd, because I have been asked, you know, is there anything about the witnesses, why they were chosen, for want of a better word, why them? And I've said, It just depends which way you look at it, the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time. It, you know, depends on your viewpoint.
Absolutely.
But they are just Mr. and Mrs. Joe Public going about their everyday routines, tasks, whatever you want to call it.
Mm.
There is some bewildering things. One of the things I concentrated on was what the late Dr. Hal Hynek, you know, the man who invented the phrase close encounters, he talked about high strangeness. In other words, the closer you get to these things, the more people that are involved, if there's any physical evidence, et cetera, then it's more unlikely that this is not a conventional object that you're witnessing. You're not misidentifying something, Paul. You know, if we see a light in the night sky whizzing along, it could be a whole host of things.
Yeah.
But when we see one of these up close and personal, which a lot of these witnesses have, it's much more difficult to say, well, they must have been mistaken.
Mm.
Because as a UFO investigator, you know that the vast majority of reports that come in have a conventional explanation. But with these cases, they are full of the what Hynek called high strangeness and therefore bewildering. And I don't have a theory behind these. I'm not out to indoctrinate anyone. I've, as always, leave the readers to make up their own mind what these accounts represent or don't.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, there's things in there that I guarantee the listeners today they will have never have heard of before.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as you were saying there, I think it's one of those aspects of human nature, Philip, that people always try to find themes or connections with people. And as you say, when it comes to people who witness UFOs, I think when you look at the whole body of evidence, there is no theme. It can be anybody that, as you say, could be right place, right time, or wrong place, wrong time. It depends what happens.
Yeah, yeah.
In the encounter, I think.
It's almost like a police profiler.
Yeah.
Trying to profile a serial killer. More often than not, they might fit a psychological profile, but, you know, a physical profile, it's your next door neighbor.
Yeah.
You know, and he said he never caused any bother. He was always very quiet.
Yeah.
Well, and it's the same with these people. They're just everyday, ordinary Joes. Mm-hmm. And not so much with the landing cases, but certainly the close encounters, the abductions, there's something that they didn't want. And, we often say the Alien Abduction Club is the only club that nobody wants to be a member of. And so we normalize the witnesses because they are normal. It's usually the media that sensationalizes these things. Mm. But the accounts are sensational enough without going down that route. You know, I've had an interest in landing cases pretty much since I first began my active role in UFO research, and that is culminated, you know, all these years later with this book, and we'll see where it goes.
Absolutely. I think to start with one particular case, Philip, this is probably one of the ones that I was aware of, more so to do with the description of the entity that these young people saw, and that's the incident that happened in Kent in 1963, which was witnessed by John Flaxton and Mervyn Hutchinson and two of their friends on a late November night, I think it was. Now, this one, I think, is one of those that occasionally pops up when people try and insert it into the Mothman history, because there does seem to be a bit of revisionism when it comes to Mothman and everything that went on around Point Pleasant. However, obviously, if you look at this on face value, Philip, people will say, oh, well, they probably had heard about the Mothman, which I find deeply unsatisfying as an explanation, because I'm probably very aware that I don't think the British newspapers were reporting on anything that was going on in Point Pleasant in 66, 67 in our tabloids and local press. But this case, obviously, because it happened in 1963, you can straight away say, well, they're not just regurgitating something they picked up, because this predates everything that happened in Point Pleasant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that is not an intentional theme throughout the book, it's just the way the phenomena is, Paul, is the bizarre nature of some of these things. And this has got the nickname of the Mothman of the UK, I mean, it happened November the 16th, 1963. Four British teenagers, you know, they were at a place called Sandling Park, I believe, and they saw this object land in a nearby forest. And it was reported as a silent, glowing, orb-like object descending from the heavens. I mean, it was self-illuminated, an ovoid object. But what is fascinating is the creature that they describe in association with this. I mean, these kids were terrified, and this humanoid figure emerged from the woods and literally, as I put, I use this word correctly, waddled towards them. And it was apparently looked like a headless bat, but was round about 5 feet tall, with large webbed feet and wings protruding from its back. And it is a bizarre encounter. And like I said, when we go back to the high strangeness factor, here we have four witnesses. They see this thing up close and personal, and there is this bizarre creature, call it what you will, being observed in association with it all. As we go back, this is 1963, and it's in a nice place. It's in Kent. It's not the middle of nowhere, and it is mind-boggling. But it's one of those cases, like you said, on occasion crops up, but it's usually more in the sort of cryptozoological areas that you might find this. But it is a bizarre case, and a lot of research has been done by it, not by me, but by other researchers at the time, and a few years later down the line, of course. And it is absolutely fascinating. I do know a UFO researcher who has a lot more information on it, and I'm just trying to persuade him to pass it along. He's not holding on to it for any other reason, that he's just very, very busy. But I've even suggested, if he has enough material in his file on this particular incident in 1963, that we publish it, you know, on its own.
Yeah.
Just as a self-standing little publication. But like I say, he's just too busy for that at the moment. So that is, you know, I don't think it will tell us anything more. It might just expand on what we already know. But an intriguing case nonetheless. And there is an artist's impression in the book of what this thing, supposedly looked like. And I make no wonder these teenagers were scared, because it would do absolutely the same to me. But again, I asked my colleagues in different parts of the world, and I'm sure there's some listening today, have you ever heard of this case? And I would say that vast majority of them will, if they're honest, will come back and say no. Well, hey, there you go. Maybe you should get a copy of the book and find out.
I mean, that there is so much about this case that makes it quite unique, as you say, because obviously at that era, Philip, it was going through this where the media would always label anybody who was dealing with something like this as seeing little green men. So, first of all, what they report seeing bears no resemblance to anything else that seemed to have been reported at the time.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not a humanoid figure. It's not a little creature. This is some kind of strange headless bat monster that they described as being about 5 foot tall. And it absolutely terrified these guys. You know what I mean? I mean, it's one of those stories where people go, oh, well, it's just kids having a laugh. And yet you think, well, if they're having a laugh, they're just going to tell you what they've probably read about or they've heard about.
Yeah, it's not from Dan Dare. I don't think, had Doctor Who started by that time in 1963? But if it had, Doctor Who was the Daleks.
Yes.
This is not a Dalek.
No.
And like I say, finding something similar to that in these, what we call the science fiction literature, prior to 1963, I think would be very difficult, if not impossible, because, you know, they were all creatures with at least had a head on it.
Yep.
And why, if you're going to make something, well, why call it a headless creature?
Yeah.
This is not the headless horseman, you know, riding down the ghostly pathway. This terrified the bejesus out of them.
Yeah.
Like I said, you know, we talked about the high strangeness factor. This is a case that has oodles of it, Paul, and is a fine example of exactly what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. It's also, for me, Philip, got one of the most ludicrous attempted explanations that I've read when it comes to UFO literature, where I think somebody claimed that what the teenagers saw was a crow illuminated by a passing electrical train, which I think, when you're talking about leaps of faith, Philip, that's certainly up there. Yeah. Because as you say in the book, at no point do they try and explain how this crow suddenly manages to look 5 foot tall. And it's the fact that they don't just glimpse it, they watch it. When you read the witness, it's like a typical horror story. They see this strange light, something lands, and they come to explore it, and then they hear all this rustling, and then this thing appears that absolutely terrifies them. Panic, fear, whatever.
I can wear my skeptical head, Paul, which you have to do, you know, as part of this. But even I would never have suggested that this was a crow that was illuminated by a passing train. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But I had to put that in there just to give an example of how these things had been dealt with. And that's one of the more, I mean, that explanation to me is more bizarre than the encounter. if you get a 5 foot headless crow flying around, then heaven help us. But yes, there you go.
I mean, it's one of those things as well, because their sighting wasn't just the standalone one, because there was a couple of other people that also saw strange things flying about at the period. And we see this occasionally, Philip, where There's an initial sighting that perhaps gets all the attention and the coverage. And sometimes these secondary and second and third accounts or whatever, or sometimes even more, often get lost. But there was clearly strange things happening in that area, because several other people said that they'd seen things in the sky as well floating about.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a lesson that we've learned in ufology. I think initially when somebody reports something to you, when you go to interview them, you concentrate on what they've contacted you about, and it's easy to forget, say, have you seen anything else, or do you know of anything, or to look in things like the local media to see if they, it's the kind of thing the police do, you know, when they're on a hunt for someone, and they'll go and speak to the, you know, the person at the crime scene, what happened, but then they'll look for other things in and around the area to see if they could be associated with that particular event. And I think it's something we should be mindful to do that as UFO researchers. I mean, for example, it's nothing to do with the book, but again, one of the most famous cases in the world is the Travis Walton encounter from back in 1976. And I saw an interview with Travis recently, and he went over his encounter. But then the interviewer said, because he was only a young man himself at the time, he said, had you ever seen UFOs before? And he said, yeah, we had a couple of little sightings. Now, who knew that?
Yeah.
Others may have done, but that was the first time I'd actually seen the words come out of Travis's mouth himself. And of course, we often look, you know, now it's much easier to look around the area. We can contact people easier and things like that. So it's not a standalone, as you said, but it is a bewildering encounter, whichever way you want to look at it. And let me say, that was in Sandling Park in Kent on November the 16th, 1963.
It's fascinating, really. And like I say, it's one of those stories that's always stuck with me, primarily because the description of this creature is so weird. And when we were talking about some of the explanations and things and people being told that they're misidentifying, one of the brilliant cases, which happens a few years later, was witnessed by a lady called Dame Rebecca West, Philip. And I like this case primarily because she was so convinced that she'd seen something really odd that she decided that she had to inform the MOD. And it's one of those encounters where, as we were saying earlier, she was just sitting at home, just admiring the view from her window, and then she saw a weird person or a figure, and it caught her attention. And it's because she saw this strange person or something, that somebody who shouldn't be there, because it was private property as well, it was her estate, I believe, she then ends up seeing some strange object that's landing.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, and it's Ibston House in Hertfordshire, not in the middle of nowhere, January 1966. I mean, she's described this. You know, she's seen somebody and she peeked out to see what was happening. And she said, this object seemed to descend quite rapidly on the other side of the hedge from the man, but very close to it. It consisted of something like a metal band. It was grey-blue in colour, flattened at one point, And this is an interesting thing. It almost seemed like leaf-like and crossed with a herringbone system of metal strips. So there's a lot of detail there. This isn't a vague object, you know, in the background somewhere. And she says there's also something attached to this, an odd object like a bag with an opening that points to a yellowish material. I mean, she said it looked like the whole thing had collapsed to the ground, and she saw it crumple and crumple. Crumple is not the right word, but this metal band seemed to curl backwards and disappear. The mystery man was seen to turn and follow the hedge track down the valley, looking once or twice to his left and then scrutinizing the valley, seemingly unaware of her presence. But at the bottom of the track, he stopped again and he looked round the slope where he was standing, this time as if he had suddenly become aware of her presence. And like you said, Dame Rebecca went on to report this incident to the MOD. And, you know, we have a copy of the, well, not a copy, but a transcript of what transpired and the letter. And can you imagine, you know, again, it's a bizarre case. And how many have heard of this before, back in 1976? I mean, the MOD's response was rather short and sharp. It said, no further evidence has become available concerning this particular sighting. So there's nothing to add, you know, and that is it. I mean, that's almost like saying, bugger off, isn't it? You know,
Stop bothering us.
It's a sort of a formal way of telling you to get lost.
Yeah.
But there you go. I mean, even when you do report these things, you know, that's well, you certainly did then. That was the kind of reaction that you were dealt with.
Mm.
But yes, an interesting case indeed, Paul.
It is. And once again, we often talk about people misidentifying things. And for any of us that have a love of this subject, as you say, you can look in the night sky, and if you're not sure what you're looking at, you can misidentify things. And obviously these days you've got the incredible sights of when the Starlink satellite system comes flying over and things like that, Philip, or the ISS.
Yeah.
I would imagine for some people who may not be aware of it or not know how to get the timings of when these things, because you can plan a sighting if you wish and go outside when they're coming over. And I've seen them a couple of times. I saw the Starlinks the other year, and it was quite haunting, actually, because it was just such a big collection of lights that if you didn't know what they were, you would think, what the hell is going on here? But when it comes to Rebecca's sighting, she's so descriptive in what she's seen. She's clearly got a good sighting of it. I mean, she even mentions that this strange humanoid figure, they're basically looking at each other, Philip. So she's obviously very aware of what she's seeing. It's, you know, it's where she lives, so she's very familiar with what's happening. And I think the MOD, because she initially wrote to them and said, this is what I think, they wrote back and said, oh, well, you've just seen a helicopter. And she's like, what? Yes. I haven't seen a helicopter. And if it is a helicopter, why are you landing on my land?
Yes, exactly. Where did it come from? And of course, you know, a helicopter is a helicopter. I mean, well, you know, even kids know what they look like. And they make such a horrendous noise.
Hmm.
There is no mistaking them. I mean, I live on the edge of town here in Pontefract, and I don't know if it's the air ambulance that goes over us or if it's the police, but it goes on a route over us, and I can sit. My wife's almost deaf. Literally, she wears hearing aids, and she'll hear it going over, and she shouldn't even have to look. She knows because of the sound it makes, that's the helicopter.
Yeah.
And she's right, of course. And, you know, I would imagine Dame Rebecca was a well-educated lady. And, you know, I think she took it as a bit of an insult that she was told that she'd seen a helicopter. And she certainly wasn't having any of that. That's why I think she wrote back.
Yeah.
And, of course, they didn't know what to say. But there you go. So even members of the, we call it the aristocracy, if you like, that even they have and are not immune from these encounters.
Absolutely. And I often find the helicopter explanation remarkable, Philip, because they're noisy buggers.
Exactly.
Whenever you see it, as you say there, we've got a couple. We've got, obviously, we live near the Peak District, so we've got Mountain Rescue, who will occasionally have to fly out in case someone's got into difficulties out there, as well as police helicopters, because obviously Sheffield's a major city. It doesn't matter what time of day or anything, you can hear that and you know exactly where it is. Doesn't matter how far away it is, you can hear a helicopter from a considerable distance, Philip. So for somebody to describe seeing something so close and also describing it as being silent, it's nonsensical that you would just... It's one of those trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, Philip.
It is, and like I say, when the helicopter comes over here, we usually hear it before we see it.
Mm.
You know, you'll hear it coming, and then over it comes, and I don't know where it's going. I don't know what it is, but it's a fairly regular occurrence around here. Probably the air ambulance, I would imagine. We live near to the motorway network, but you wouldn't misidentify a helicopter if it's landing on your front lawn, would you? I mean, come on.
Absolutely not. No, and it's once again, it's one of those things. You know, we've had a crow illuminated by a train, Philip. Now we've got silent helicopters.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
There's always an I often find sometimes the explanation is more baffling than the actual witness sighting.
Yeah. Well, a 5-foot headless crow. Yeah, I mean, but there you go.
I mean, one of the other great UK cases, flaps, situations, Philip, which I think these days is another one of these cases or these series of events that people have just written off as being a hoax. Which is everything that starts in Warminster.
Mm.
And it's one of those that I've seen a couple of people who came forward and claim. I mean, one guy was the one guy that said he'd come across a load of dead birds and then he ended up 20 years later or something saying it was a load of nonsense. But there are so many sightings in the Warminster area. Obviously, it became known as the Warminster thing. And people were reporting it for all over. But I think... For a lot of people, the first or probably the most famous person involved with Warminster was Arthur Shuttleworth.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed to be one of those people that when a case occurs, Philip, he sort of gets really enmeshed in it and he becomes sort of the primary collector of the information. So
absolutely.
So I was going to say, with Warminster, when I'm reading through the chapter in the 60s, there are a couple of things that occur before the big one, because I think the big one starts in about 1967, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, Arthur Shuttleworth was a local journalist in Warminster. And initially, what was the Warminster thing started off as you know, strange noises that people would hear. And they used the noises because on the outskirts of Warminster, of course, there is the military. There's a military barracks there. I believe it's an officer training place.
Mm.
And just beyond, when you get, I've been in Warminster several times, the famous vantage point for viewing things is Cradle Hill. But once you get up over the top of Cradle Hill, of course, what you see beyond you is Salisbury Plains. And we do know that the British Army do manoeuvres on there. So the town we're used to, you know, all things military, the military barracks are still there as best as I know. But like I said, it was Arthur himself. And in fact, I met him once and I didn't know it was him.
Mm.
Because when I met him, I just got interested in the subject. And we were actually on Cradle Hill. And this chap just come wandering along and said, you know, evening gents, have you seen anything? No. And off he went. And it wasn't until sometime later when I bought one of his books, I said to my friend who had been with me, I said, that's that chap we met that night. And I subsequently corresponded with him on and off for a number of years. He's no longer with us, of course, now he's in Arthur. But he was the one that, if you like, you know, brought the Warminster thing out into the public domain. And you know, had his own sightings as well. And one of those is featured in the book. And that was August the 27th, 1967. And it was just outside of the town, Cradle Hill. And Arthur went on to write a number of books himself. And they are fascinating to read because they reflect the era of the 1960s and what was happening in and around Warminster at the time. I mean, I've taken, you know, foreign visitors to Warminster and we've had a look around and, you know, it's a lovely place as well. It's Wiltshire. It is a very nice, but Warminster was the UFO center for quite some time. And he's still referred to as that now, even though the phenomenon is not as active as it used to be in the 1960s.
Mm.
So again, you know, we concentrate on little things like that. But, you know, again, Warminster is one of those places in modern ufology that it's fallen by the wayside. You know, there may be newcomers to the subject have never heard of what happened there. you know, and it is significant what the things that happened there, and we shouldn't forget that.
Yeah, I think it is, like I said there, I think because it's one of those cases where somebody's come forward and gone, oh, well, it was me. And often when you read the media, Philip, they will just latch onto that and go, oh, well, that's explained it all now. That's it. It's done. Finished. Over. And you think, well, when it comes to the Warminster incidents, there are so many that I find it remarkable that all of that gets ignored for two people. I mean, there's one guy that, obviously, the geologist, I think he was, who claimed about this mass death of birds or something of that nature, Philip. And then I think there was a kid who claimed he'd had a sighting and he drew a picture of it and it got printed in the Daily Mirror, I think. And then he came forward and said, yeah, we were just lying about it. But as your report about Shuttleworth sighting, he saw, along with several other people, they saw something land behind some trees. Now, yeah, that has no connection to anything that these two people who came forward to say they were putting themselves into the story have any control over, as there are some of the other sightings that you mentioned, because I think there are about three or four from Warminster from the 60s and 70s, Philip.
Yeah, I mean, Arthur said, you know, they observed a cone-shaped object. It descended, it landed in a clump of trees about 1,000 yards away. And he was interviewed sometime later with Arthur. He said there was other people with him. I'll read the little quote. And he said, I advised onlookers to stay at a safe distance while I explored the area. The landed UFO was shooting out beams of bright light from a conical and revolving ring. It will tax the reader too harshly if I recount exactly what happened some 300 yards away from the glowing UFO and whom I spoke to. Said, near a rustic gate separating two large fields, I became terrified. Soon afterwards, in spite of being with other people, the UFO blacked out after about 6 minutes, and he went along the hedgerow, skirting the edge of the copse, walking back. He was struck by the utter silence of the night birds and the other creatures around him. He said he passed down a second copse for a few seconds, stopped to glance up the stairs at the stars. He said he placed his hand on the hedge to steady himself. And he said, it spooked him. And an interesting thing he mentions in passing there, because it's been mentioned in a number of encounter cases, was this. It's even in the movie Close Encounters, where the wildlife falls silent.
Mm.
So everything around you goes silent. If you think of, you know, Roy Neary in Close Encounters, where he's driving his truck and he comes to the junction and everything goes quiet, you know, and then poof, the lights hit him from above. Now, our colleague Jenny Randalls, I think she was the one who invented the phrase to do with the Wizard of Oz, you know, the Oz factor, not the X factor, the Oz factor, where everything seems to go quiet around you. All the natural sounds, you know, the birds, the wind, and Arthur mentions that, but he mentions it just in passing. It's not something that he's emphasizing. And that is reported in a number of encounters, but around the world, Paul, not just here in the UK.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fascinating little bit of an interesting encounter. And so, you know, Warminster was the place in the 1960s. And, there's a photograph of Cradle Hill on the top of there. I don't know if it's still there, but there used to be a barn and a few trees, just a little copse of trees. And there was various bits of graffiti written on the barn. I'm not sure if I left my name there, but... you know, but it was certainly an interesting place, and it's a great place to stay as well. It's a centre for all the tourism in Wiltshire. What is interesting, nothing to do with this account, but just a couple of miles away is Longleat Safari Park.
Yes.
You know, set up by the Marquis of Bath many, many years ago. And I was actually invited to lecture there one year. They had a balloon festival. And two of the balloons that they had, one was Richard Branson's Virgin Flying Saucer balloon.
Yeah.
And there was a balloon for Independence Day, the movie. And I actually lectured in a big marquee in the grounds at Longleat House all about UFOs. And I met the Marquis, and then and his son, who you know, the old boy, has passed away now. Mm. But there is a lot of interest still in the Warminster phenomena. But like I say, it's tend to have fallen by the wayside. Hence, it's in the book.
Absolutely. And I think it is, for us here in the UK, I think it's one of those cases we need to sort of bring back into the light, Philip, because as I was saying there, they just seem to have dismissed it out of hand, which I find odd. It's one of those things, it's like the Phoenix Lights, that all the witnesses were discounted because a kid said he saw some paragliders. And you just think, well, if 800 people say they see this thing, and one person says they give you the rational explanation, why would you ignore the vast majority of people for one person's account? That, to me, is nonsensical, isn't it?
Yeah, and the things at Warminster were seen over a period of time as well. Mm. I'm talking years. This wasn't a one-off event where a few idiots, you know, joined in and made fool of it. It was an ongoing thing. There was a place there called the Star Centre.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, and they used to have a little newsletter and things like that. And Stonehenge is not that far away. Avebury Stone Circle is not that far away. So, you know, Warminster is in amongst all these ancient mysteries and the military. And perhaps it all combined, and hey presto, the UFO phenomena manifested there in the 1960s. Who knows, mate? Who knows?
Well, exactly. If anything, I mean, there's enough tourists on this planet go around there, Philip. Why would people from somewhere else not want to come and visit these items?
There you go. There you go.
Well, the next one I want to look at is something that's closer to both of us, which is a sighting that occurred in the town I was born in, which is Barnsley, in 1972. And Philip, I have to be brutally honest, I'd never heard of this at all, which I find very odd, because it happened in the year of my birth, 1972. And for me, I'm shocked, because I had no idea that anything like this had ever been reported where I grew up. There's been several strange things happen in and around Sheffield, and obviously I live near the Peak District, which was a hotspot as well, especially in the 80s and 90s. And yeah. Jenny, as we mentioned earlier, Jenny Randalls did a lot of work about things that were happening over the Peak District and going all the way to the top end. Obviously, you've got Todmorden, which is still occasionally seeing strange things. So I was struck by this primarily because when I read the account, I knew exactly where it had happened and the area they were talking about and the place this thing was supposed to have landed. And I think it's one of those things that this book's brilliant at things like this, because like I say, Philip, I've often looked for really weird things in my local area. And I'm amazed at how often these things just get completely forgotten about, or they just get ignored or whatever. And this is one of those sightings where it clearly had an emotional impact, because it was seen by a dad and his two kids. And his kids were absolutely terrified by what happened.
Yeah. I mean, it was a Mr. Anthony Cureton, Barnsley, South Yorkshire. I'm a Yorkshireman. I'm not that far from Barnsley where we are. January 1972. I mean, again, we emphasised at the beginning that people were just about their everyday lives when these things happen. I mean, Mr. Cureton and his two children were out walking the family dog, you know, and, you know, about 150 yards from their house in a place called Kendray in Barnsley. Like I said, you know the place. It's about 7:30, and they saw this strange-looking torpedo-shaped craft, which appeared to have two or three levels to it, all full of dark lights with a halo around it, and it descended vertically. The object then was about 700 feet away from them. It landed on the other side of a 6-foot-high concrete wall. It was formerly the boundary line to a complex of football fields. And like you said, you know the area. And according to the two children, a pointed face then popped up above the wall, showing pointed ears and large eyes. Frightened, the children ran back to tell their father, who was trailing a short distance behind them. On looking back, there was no sign of the craft or the entity. Mr. Cureton confirmed that the children arrived home in a very frightened state and refused to go out in the dark for some time afterwards. Jacqueline, who was apparently the worst affected by the experience, could remember little about what had taken place, whereas Tony, who was older, had no place remembering. With clarity and of what he witnessed. Mr. Cureton said, "I remember Tony mentioning this event from time to time and didn't attach of much importance to it. Besides that, there was a story of a UFO landing in a nearby school playing fields back in the 1950s, but you know, we've been unable to locate any details of that. So the father tends to play it down somewhat, but confirms that his children were affected by that. It's in his daughter. It's almost as if she's forced it from her mind. And that's what happened with frightening experiences. Sometimes we try to put it to the back of our mind. We don't want to be reliving it. But the elder of the two siblings remembered it vividly. And it is, again, a little puzzling case. We don't have that much detail about it, but it's one, like you said, you're from the area and you'd never heard of it before. And it's just another example.
It is. And like you say about the reactions that the children had, I find that very interesting that they both had such completely opposite effects in regards to what they'd witnessed and what they saw, Philip. And it was obvious that Jacqueline was clearly that scared. And as we're aware, and several cases, not just in the world of ufology, when we're talking about other strange subjects, some people will create, you know, their brains or their minds will create a safety net where it basically pushes it away, out of the way, so it doesn't bother them. It's very strange to me because it's one of those where people say, oh, well, it could have been somebody mucking about. Now, I know that area. That's not the kind of place you would go creeping about wearing a mask trying to frighten somebody, Philip, because you're more likely to drop on somebody who'd give you a bloody nose.
Absolutely. I mean, it kind of reminds me, although it's not connected, but it kind of reminds me of people coming back from the military. And, you know, they've been in combat, perhaps seen colleagues get hurt or worse, and they don't talk about it. They kind of fob it off. It's a way of dealing with it. I mean, my father was a, you know, prime example. I mean, he had a big hole in the back of his leg. He'd been in the army during the Second World War and got blown up.
Yeah.
And the shrapnel took a lump out of the back of his leg when they were under fire. Would he tell me anything about it? Not on your life. He would not discuss it at all. He just fubbed it off. And he was in active service throughout the war. And I could write on one page what I know about his wartime exploits. He wasn't a spy or anything. He was just a regular soldier, you know, but he refused to talk about it. And that was it. And this is I know it's a different subject. I know, but it's kind of a similar type of thing. When something scary has happened to you, there is that coping mechanism that I think we all have. Some of us use it, some of us don't. Obviously, we're all different. We all deal with, we like to know, oh, if that happened to me, I'd do this, that, and the other. And you can say that about on a number of things, but when it actually comes to it, you don't act like that. We're all different, and you know, things affect us all differently. The same thing, you and I could witness, like these two children, the same thing.
Yeah.
Maybe a road traffic accident, but we, you know, maybe there was fatalities. We would deal with it in different ways. I mean, I've got a friend who was a paramedic most of his life. He was in the army before that as a medic. And he's been at the scenes of many, you know, road traffic accidents with people badly hurt. Didn't bother him at all. My daughter, she was a crime scene investigator for the police. And she's been to a number of locations where there were deceased individuals. And it did not bother, does not bother her at all. You know, she never bats an eyelid about it. And then for many years before I took ill myself, I worked in a factory. And I remember one gentleman we had, he was just as tough as they come. He had muscles on his muscles, Paul, and frightened of nothing apart from a needle.
Yeah.
You say you've got to have an injection and he would be off like a bat out of hell. And he was a big guy. Yeah. Like I say, a real tough fella. Show him a needle and he was gone. I mean, because of my illness, I've had many blood tests. And I was talking to a lady and checking my blood one day. And she said, we had a chap, he didn't even get in through the door. And she said, I was getting the syringe ready and he passed out in the doorway. He didn't even get that far, you know. But, and it's just a little needle. It doesn't hurt. But, you know. So we have these mechanisms, and sometimes it happens to us and sometimes it doesn't. But I think with these two young children, there's a prime example of that. And again, a fascinating little account.
Absolutely. It's interesting what you say there. I know we mentioned him briefly earlier at the beginning of the conversation. Bob Taylor, who was...
Yes.
He served in the army in the Second World War. I think he was in the tank division.
Right.
Philip. He saw some horrific things because I think he ended up liberating a couple of concentration camps as part of his advance through Europe. And from what I gather, he had never spoken about these events at all, which is why a lot of people gave a lot more credence to his reporting of what happened to him, because they were saying, well, he's seen some horrendous things that he never spoke about, never wanted to talk about them, which, you know, like you were saying about your dad and what happened to him. A lot of that generation saw some horrendous things that they just kept to themselves, or like you say, they compartmentalized it. They put it somewhere where it was just safe, probably for their own sanity, I would imagine, Philip. And yet, when we talk in regards to UFO witnesses and some of the accounts, you'll get two types of people. You'll get the people who want to talk about it and the other people who just think it's the worst thing that's ever happened to them.
Yeah, I mean, some people think it's something that we should all be aware of, that we should know about it. Something's happened here and it's important. They don't know why it's important. It just is. Mm. And like I said, there are others that you know, would rather not talk about it at all, or talk about it reluctantly. Mr. Taylor, of course, November 1979, Livingston, Scotland. He was a forestry worker, headed to work that morning to Deckmont Woods in his truck with his dog, parked the truck up, walked down a dirt track, and there's a small clearing, and it sat there on the ground as this dome-shaped object, and Mr. Taylor said it had a flange around the bottom, and it had these little things sticking up off the flange, up like mini, you know, propeller head blades. And then out from behind this thing, or from underneath it, came these two balls, black balls with spikes on it. He said they looked like the sea mines from the Second World War. And it was muddy, and he actually heard them plopping along the ground towards him. These spikes were digging in. They got up the side of him, and he felt this tug on his trousers, and then he was out cold. And I think when he regained consciousness, he heard this whistling noise. There was a strong smell of sulfur. I think his dog was doing somersaults almost. He was spinning around. And he got up, he staggered back to his truck and tried to drive it home, and he couldn't. So he walked home. And when he got to the door, he was met by his wife. And she said, you know, he was a bit disheveled. He was got some dirt on him. And she said, what's happened? And he said, I've been assaulted. So she sat him down. And of course, they rang the police. If you've been assaulted, it's the obvious thing to do. And he told him the story. He went to the hospital, but I think he got fed up of waiting in the hospital and came home. But the police went to the scene, and there were these markings only in that area. There were like some caterpillar tracks and some other sort of oval-shaped depressions in the grass. Luckily for them, it was cold. It froze that night, so it preserved the markings. I think they taped them off. And so they did a diagram of all these markings and then photographed them as well. And this is the only UFO encounter in the UK where the police have conducted a forensic examination. So they tested Mr. Taylor's trousers. Mm-hmm. They were the heavy, heavy working trousers. There were rips on the side where he felt these tugs. And I have a copy of the police report, the forensic report, and they said that was consistent with these things being pulled upwards, you know, and ripped. And like I said, along with my colleague, Malcolm Robinson, I interviewed Mr. Taylor some years after the event, but he was just an ordinary, honest gentleman who recounted the story. Had no idea what the hell had happened to him. He wasn't interested in anything like this. This will make it, you know, an amusing little thing happened. When we went back to the site, the trees had obviously grown somewhat, and where this clearing was, the council had put in a picnic bench and some seats. It was concreted into the ground.
Mm.
So just off the cuff, I mentioned to Malcolm Robinson, why don't you get a little brass plaque made and screw it onto the bench, you know, about Robert Taylor?
Yeah.
Malcolm took that idea and ran with it, much to his credit, I may add, and he contacted the local council, and rather than just a little plaque, they put a huge, great stone cairn with a plaque built into that. And in recent years, there's even signage gone up telling you about the incident and pointing to where it happened. And again, it's all thanks down to Malcolm Robinson. I think he did a great job with that.
Yeah.
But it was a fascinating encounter, because we have to remember that the police conducted a forensic investigation.
Mm.
And they did that because Mr. Taylor was such an upstanding member of the community. Like you've pointed out, he also served during the war in some quite difficult circumstances. And it appeared he was on Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World TV
program
as well. Some overseas, I mean, Malcolm's written a full book about all of this, which I can't remember the name of it. I have read it. I would recommend it to anyone. But it is, again, a fascinating account. What is one little element about the case that tends to get overlooked is when Mr. Taylor said it, there's this dome-shaped object sat there on the ground. He said part of the dome was transparent, but he went on to add that transparency actually moved. It wasn't always in the same place at the same time. A little thing. And I think that is telling us something. I don't know what, but it's a little unique thing. The whole dome wasn't transparent. Part of it was kind of transparent, but that transparency moved and shifted. And again, it's kind of unique to this particular case.
Yeah.
And it's often overlooked.
Mm. I mean, I've obviously got to know Malcolm. And like you say, when you gave him that idea, if there's one thing I've got to know about Malcolm is if you give him the kernel of an idea, he will just grab it with both hands and just do everything that you expect. Because I know he's even recently got a plaque installed to celebrate the Beatles' first performance in Scotland recently, which is, Malcolm's a deeply passionate man about several subjects. So I'm not surprised that Malcolm would run with that, because he's a very passionate and down-to-earth individual.
Yeah, I think they're actually going to raise a plaque to the pub where Malcolm first bought me a pint in Scotland. But you're right, it was just a little off-the-cuff remark, because at that time, unless you knew where this incident took place, you would have walked straight past it. I mean, a picnic bench is a picnic bench.
Yeah.
But like I said, to his credit, Malcolm took the idea and ran with it. Mm. And like I say, his book on this case is fascinating. And as we mentioned earlier, Paul, there were some other sightings in and around the area at the time. Even though it's Decamont Woods, there is a motorway runs, close by.
Yeah.
Livingston itself is sort of in between Glasgow and Edinburgh, if somebody's thinking of the location, and there is a motorway runs between the two cities, of course. So it's not in the middle of nowhere. It's a local forest where this took place. So there's a lot more to it than we've touched on here, but a fascinating incident nonetheless.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been lucky enough when I met Malcolm a couple of years ago in Pontefract, when I met yourself, Philip.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he'd fetched Bob Taylor's trousers with him. So I've held those trousers. I know how sturdy they were. That would have taken some real effort to rip them. Because I know people say, oh, well, he caught it on a thorn bush or whatever. I mean, I've seen so many nonsensical explanations for this. Whatever happened there with those trousers, something took a lot of effort to rip them. Because they were really heavy-duty working trousers. It's not just something, oh, he caught it on a fence or something. Something had to give them a real tug to rip them.
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen them. I've got photographs of them. I've seen the marks in the ground. These marks were there and only there. They weren't anywhere else. There was no vehicle marks apart from his own. And he knew the area like the back of his hand. This was his place of work.
Mm.
And what happened to him, he's no idea. And neither have I. It's just a fascinating account. And of course, don't forget the police. Had they not thought there was something to this, they wouldn't have wasted their time and their money doing a forensic investigation. And I have covered this in the book, but not in enough detail, but enough to keep you happy, I think.
I think one of the other interesting aspects of this book as well, Philip, is that often when we have these incidents, it's usually a unique encounter for a witness. But There's a really fascinating one that happens around 1977, which was a lady called Pauline Broadhurst and her three children, which was in a place called Clifton Campville, I think, in the Midlands. What's interesting about this case for me is that they have two encounters 5 days apart. I think one's 7th of December and the other one's 12th, I think. And it's, once again, you've got a sighting with multiple witnesses. Very down to earth, family, mum and her three kids. These are not excitable people. These are not people into the subject. These are not people who are obsessed with watching science fiction films. And they have two incidents that are both you would say, I mean, obviously the family believed that there was some connection with them, yet they're both quite different in what happens, and they have very different reactions to the sightings, because the first one just seems to be a strange light, and the second one is one of those where it causes such a reaction in people, strange things happen and nearly get hurt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like I say, you know, Clifton Campbell is in Staffordshire, and the sightings were December the 7th and December the 12th, respectively. I think Clifton Campbell is just outside of Tamworth in Staffordshire.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you know, Mrs. Broadhurst was a mother a witness to the main event. But three of her children are also seen a, in inverted commas, a strange thing some time ago. But it is, as we mentioned earlier on, we tend to concentrate on the encounter that's been reported and not ask about other things. And I think we've learned, you know, with that down the years to say, oh, you know, anything else. I'll give you an example. In the 80s, we got a letter from a gentleman in North Yorkshire. Said he'd seen this, that, and the other. So we decided, you know, we'd go and pay him a visit. And he lived in this little village. And me and my colleague, when we got there, we got his letter in hand. The village was just a handful of houses, Paul. There was no numbers on the doors, and we got his letter. So we just knocked on the first door we came to and said, do you know where Mr. So-and-so lives?
Yeah.
And then he said, have you come about the ghost dog? What do you mean? And this lady told us that on occasion, these two red lights would float down through the village. They were the eyes of the ghost dog.
Mm.
So, you know, there was other sightings not just in the vicinity, but actually in and around the village. And we found the gentleman and interviewed him. And of course, he just talked about these strange lights in the village. He didn't call them a ghost dog or anything like that, but he'd seen them on several occasions. This lady prompted us to ask, you know, we thought, well, just see if others have seen it down the village, maybe it's something that happens every now and again. He said, oh yeah, you know, I'd seen it before. So it's not uncommon sometimes for several sightings to be linked. You just got to ask the question.
Yeah.
But there you go. So this was a strange encounter indeed. And I'm sure you said it was a typical December day, you know, temperatures were down low. And there was a few frost and stars. What is good about this encounter, we've got a picture of all the children, all four children that were involved, and we've got drawings of what was seen. And you'll see that the drawings are similar in some descriptions, but also different in others. And that's a little experiment we did some years ago at Beaufort at a conference. We gave everybody a pen and a piece of paper and said, we're going to show you the picture. All we want you to do is draw it. So we flashed up on the screen a flying saucer, you know, like a Damsky saucer. And we had it on the screen, I think it was for 45 seconds. We asked people to draw it and write down how long they thought they'd seen it for. And they handed these in. So at the end of the lecture, we brought these pictures out. And it was amazing the differences in some of the photographs. But when we look at these four little drawings here in this book, that apart from one, they've all got similar little things to them.
Mm.
So they're not that far out. So there you go. You know, I don't want to say too much. I want to tempt people.
Yes.
To come and read the book. I mean, I'd love to. I mean, they've seen this object and she says, I'll give you a little quote. She says, by now it's very close. Its physical attributes being plainly visible in the fading light. It was shaped like a convex lens, perfectly symmetrical, about a central horizontal axis. The strange craft was rotating slowly in an anti-clockwise direction as they looked at it. The diameter was approximately 2.5 yards, and it appeared to be made of a dull white metal. Around the central axis were two coloured bands, one red and one blue. On the underside was a small curved protrusion, this being the same dull white colour of the craft. Surrounding this were four metal protrusions. These the girls likened to landing legs in inverted commas. On top of the object were two flashing lights on silver cylinders. They were the same blue and red colours of the bands around the centre of the object. As the object approached, they heard a quiet buzzing stroke humming noise. They all said this was like the humming of a swarm of bees. It passed directly overhead, and was later estimated to be about 6 yards from the girls. They watched spellbound as it circled over them and headed back from where it had come. As it moved away, the humming noise decreased and the object slowly descended into Lullington Woods, some 2 miles away. After a few seconds, it suddenly shot up from the wood and disappeared into the sky in a near vertical ascent. The total duration of the sighting was difficult to estimate, although a suggested 30 seconds to 3 minutes was estimated. As the object descended into the woods, the girls became very frightened and ran off down the field. Lynn and Linda went to Lynn's house and Sally and Gina hurried to Sally's. Sally was scared and her mother phoned the police. Later that day, a constable from Tamworth Police arrived and took a statement. After interviewing all the witnesses, the investigators looked to see if there was a conventional explanation for this second sighting and landing. They could find nothing that could have been misidentified as something unusual. There were no helicopters in the area, and the witnesses had seen was labelled as unidentified. I mean, you know, that's a crazy little thing. Even though we talked about the children before being scared, this thing descended into the woods a couple of miles away, but it still scared the bejesus out of them. And off they went, which, you know, if you think about it, is an obvious reaction.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen kids be scared of something, and what do they do? They usually scream.
Yeah.
And turn and run, yeah. You know, and it's usually a worm or a frog or something like that, you know, nothing sinister. So it's a natural reaction. It really is. I mean, my eldest girl, I mean, she's got a family of her own now, you know, she's in her 30s.
Mm.
But as a youngster, anything that flew or fluttered, birds, butterflies, bugs, you name it, would scare the living daylights out of her and she'd be off. She wouldn't go near them.
Yeah.
And still doesn't like anything like that.
I mean, the thing about this case as well is with the girls, one of them was riding their pony and they were so shocked, yeah, they fell off.
Yeah, they did, yeah. Yeah. You know, and again, you know, there's no helicopters in the area. They would have made a din. Maybe the horse might have legged it if it'd been the noise from a helicopter.
Yeah.
There was a little noise like a swarm of bees. And again, you know, there's been a number of sightings down the years where there's been a low hum or a buzzing noise, usually silent, but, you know, that's not uncommon.
Yeah.
And an interesting part of the whole sighting, of course.
Absolutely. It's remarkable, really. And once again, here we have somebody, a parent, who's so concerned about how their child's reacted. They phoned the police, Philip. So clearly they, yeah, put a lot of credit, yeah, in what their child was telling them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it just seems a sensible thing to do.
Mm.
They've seen something bizarre. It has scared the children. So who do you call? Well, there's no Ghostbusters, but there is the police. As we mentioned with Mr. Taylor, you know, beforehand, the police had something to work with there. You know, he had torn trousers. I think he's even, this went through to his skin, mm-hmm, and there were little scratches on his skin.
Yeah.
So there was physical evidence. There was, you know, when they went to the scene, there was marks on the ground. This gave them something to work with,
yeah,
rather than just a statement. When it's just a statement, It's difficult to know what to do.
Mm.
What you do is you tick off all the conventional ideas, like the investigators have mentioned. There was no helicopters or anything like that in the area. So we have no, you know, there's nothing there that could have caused this. And hey, presto, you know, we're left with something that's unidentified. And the police would have come to the same conclusion, no doubt.
I think there's one case, Philip, that happens a couple of years later, and I'm sad to say, I didn't know much about this, and I've read it, and I'm absolutely blown away by this, primarily because this is someone that you got to know quite well, which is a lady called Linda Jones from Didsbury,
oh, yes,
Manchester.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, this is one of those cases that, as we've said about some of these that we've spoke about during our conversation, Philip, I cannot believe that this is discussed, but there often seems to be a certain sort of tolerance in the world of ufology, that if certain stories go outside, if we could call this a normal conversation, or the normal parameters of UFO encounters or sightings, Philip, often when something goes a little bit further or challenges people's perceptions of what we understand or think we understand is going on in a lot of these cases, this case just shakes it all to its foundations, because it is remarkable what, yeah, Linda's claims occurred to both her and her children over a considerable length of time.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've met Linda, you know, several times. She's a lovely lady. I met her husband, Trevor, as well. And I remember speaking to Linda about this. And one thing I asked a number of witnesses was, what do you believe, think was the nature and origin of your experience? What was this? And Linda said it was almost biblical.
Mm.
That's how, that was the only way she could describe what had happened to her and her children. It was biblical. And I've never heard anyone describe a UFO encounter exactly like that. And but Linda did. What we should also look here as well, the date is August 19th, 1979. If you are interested in, you know, really high strangeness cases, the decade in the UK to concentrate on them was the 1970s. For whatever reason, Paul, there may be multiple reasons.
Yeah.
But doing this research, you find that the 1970s, it could have been that there were simply more active investigators in the 1970s. Therefore, more information was, more cases were dug up, or they had somebody to listen to or somebody to report them to. There could be a whole number of reasons, but the 1970s were certainly a type top, of course, by Alan Godfrey.
Yeah.
You could argue if you wanted, but we won't, but you could argue it was all topped off by Rendlesham in 1980. But the 19th, I just got interested myself and become partially involved in 1979. I sort of started in 1980, so I was at the back end of all this, but I had access to some of these information.
Mm.
And Linda's account is long and fascinating. And it's difficult to summarize it in a chat like we are here.
Yeah.
But all I'll say is she described, I asked her straight up, what do you think it was, Linda? Is this nuts and bolts? Is it aliens? You know, what? She said it was biblical. And make of that what you will. And like I've said all along, you know, there's no attempt to indoctrinate anybody with this book. I don't have any theories of what lies behind these encounters. In fact, what I do at the end, I actually go to my colleagues around the country,
mm-hmm,
and say, look, what do you think happened? What's your opinion? And they're all pretty much different. And when you look at the book as a whole, Linda's coverage in the book is probably takes up more page room than maybe any of the other encounters. So that'll give you some idea of how difficult it is,
yeah,
to summarize it. But if you want to laugh, there's a picture of me with Robert Taylor and an old colleague of mine, David Kelly, with Mr. Taylor, with Robert Taylor. And I've got permed hair from the 1980s, and it's still got to be chuckled. Even I wish I still had some of that hair now, Paul. You know what I mean?
Yeah, me and you both, Philip.
Yeah, it makes me chuckle when I see it. But this is not a criticism of any researchers today. But back in those days when I started, Paul, the only way to get information was either on the telephone or in writing or in person.
Mm.
And I used to literally have a little kit bag. In there was my camera, some extra batteries, you know, lenses and things like that, a tape recorder, again with extra batteries, and a notebook and pen. I used to chuck that in the back of the car, and my wife said, you know, what time will you be home? And I used to just shrug my shoulders because I didn't have any idea. There was no sat-nav,
yeah,
to try and find when you're going to these people. So
plan your route.
Yeah, but I look upon it as I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to meet some of these people and speak to them in person, like Linda Taylor. I wasn't the original investigator, but I had the opportunity to speak to her myself, like Robert Taylor. And one of the two others who saw things back in the 1940s and the 1950s, I was able to do that as well. You get a nice grip of things when you actually meet these people. And like I said, like we said again right at the beginning, they're just, you know, your everyday Mr. and Mrs. Jones, you know, ordinary people about that. I mean, Linda was out in the back of her house picking wildflowers.
Yeah.
You know, when the encounter happened, as we said, Robert Taylor on his way down to work in Detmont Woods, a job he'd done 1,000 times before when these things happened. So, but yes, and it did. I haven't seen Linda in a long while, but I think she's doing okay. But she's a lovely lady and a fascinating encounter.
Absolutely. Would you say this is one of Britain's most compelling alleged abduction cases, Philip, because clearly something strange went on, because as you describe, and as you say, it's a lengthy section, but
yeah.
I think it's a case that I find remarkable that it's not held up. However, as I was sort of referring to, I think because of everything that went on, because we've got missing time. I mean, one of the things that stands out for me is it's a daughter that sees it first, and she describes it as the moon is coming towards us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a daughter shouts out, "Mum, the moon is coming towards us. They're out picking wildflowers." Link turned to see this strange object racing across the sky, traveling towards them. And I'll quote what she said. She said it was like the shape of a rugby ball, only a lot bigger, and was a bright orange in colour, recalled Linda. It had come into view from behind a crop of trees on the golf course situated on the other side of the river. The object had a spinning effect, and it seemed to be travelling towards us at an angle. "Get down," Linda shouted. "Get down in the grass." And she crouched down in the tall grass with her two children next to her. She braced herself for an explosion, initially thinking that it may have been a plane from the nearby Manchester airport in trouble or on fire. There was no sound whatsoever. Slowly looking up out of the grass, Linda saw the strange object pass overhead and then suddenly drop in a vertical motion behind an embankment, which was part of the flooding defence of the River Mersey. It was then she realised the strangeness of the strangeness of the total silence. Not even the sound of birds nor traffic from the distant busy roads of Didsbury Centre. And we mentioned that in the case before, this Oz factor, where all the natural sounds, everyday sounds around you just seem to disappear. And there's total silence. And here's Linda saying exactly the same thing. Like I say, it doesn't happen in every case, but it just crops up every now and again. And here we have another example of it. And there's some cracking descriptions of an artist's impressions of what she saw.
Mm.
But again, we have to remember Didsbury is just outside of Manchester. It's a busy little town. You know, Manchester's one of the main cities in the UK. And like she said, she's thinking, like a lot of people do, Paul, they think rationally first.
Yeah.
You know, this must be an aircraft, because aircraft fly over here all the time going into Manchester Airport, one of the main airports in the north of England, of course. And she thinks it's in trouble, it's going to crash. And she says, "Duck, you know, get down, brace yourself." But then she realised, hang on a minute, there's something not right here.
Yeah.
And then when she pops her head back, because she's waiting for the explosion, this thing stops in the air and silently drops to the ground. So it's whatever it is, it's not an airplane that's gonna crash, incoming or outgoing from Manchester Airport.
Yeah.
And then Linda goes on to say, Linda stood with her children in hand, taking a few steps towards the embankment, wondering if whatever it was had crashed. Linda had a compelling urge to move closer to the top of the embankment, first walking and then running up. She was suddenly stopped dead in her tracks by an amazing sight. There, about 20 yards in front of her, lay an object which she could only describe as biblical looking. It was so weird. Linda did not know anything about UFOs, nor had any interest in the subject. With her children stood beside her, Linda stared at the object, taking in all the detail. The object was about 60 feet across and hovering 2 or 3 feet above the ground. The object was, this is really bizarre. The object was disappearing and then reappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And we could go on, you know, that we could go on and on and on. I think it'll give you a bit of an idea of what is to come. But like I said, those are Linda's words, biblical. I mean, biblical looking. What?
Yeah.
I've tried to imagine what she's seeing, even though we've got artist's impressions here, and I can't do it. I haven't got that imagination, Paul. But just think about putting yourself in that place at that time, and the lady stood next to you. Is that it's biblical looking? And you don't misidentify somebody on a push bike and call it biblical looking, or you know, At least the helicopter theory didn't come up here, I'm happy to say. But it is, it's awe-inspiring almost. That's the way I look at it. I really do.
Absolutely. And it's one of those as well, because we've got the kids.
Yeah.
Because often people say, oh, well, they were hallucinating. I am unaware of any phenomenon that causes everybody to hallucinate the same thing at the same time.
Well, I'm the same. And what Linda did, like any natural parent in the early days of this, of course, she wouldn't put a kids out front in front of the newspapers. They were kept. She protected her children.
Yeah.
When discussing this encounter, and you know, Linda's a lovely, lovely lady, but she's just like you and me, Paul. She's just an everyday lady, and her husband Trevor, like I said, they wouldn't stand out in a crowd. And this thing happened to her. And it has puzzled Linda from that day.
Yeah.
She'd love to know what was behind all this. And you feel that when you speak to her. I wish I could give her an answer, but I can't. And there's a lot more to the story. And if you're interested in that kind of thing, I was thinking to myself when writing the book, should I include what would we this is an abduction case. So that gives you some idea what's coming up. I was wondering whether I should use abduction cases or not, and just stick with pure landings and encounters. But I thought Linda's account is so fascinating that no, it's got to go in.
Yeah,
it's got to be there, because again, we keep repeating it, but a lot of our colleagues around the globe will have never heard of it.
Yeah,
and it is a fascinating and important encounter. And the strange beings involved, there's missing time and a whole host of things. I put in the book, I asked Linda to describe the object she had seen back in 1979, simply for the fact that human perception does alter as the years pass. I was privy to the original information report. The object was nothing like what is generally reported as a UFO. It was not disc-shaped nor triangular in shape. I've looked through many books. I've never seen anything that looks remotely like what she saw. That's Linda, like I saw. So even Linda has looked for an answer elsewhere, and she's not come across anything like it. So there you go.
Yeah. I think that's what kind of takes it to a new level as well, like you say, Philip. Often these cases, people will see the archetypal flying disc or black triangles or whatever. This case is just so different. Like we were saying about the Flaxton and Hutchinson sighting with the headless bat thing in the beginning. It's what makes it stand out for me is it's so unique in the pantheon of reports that it can't be misidentification or somebody who's got an overactive imagination or somebody that's making up, because usually if they make things up, they tend to fall into the tropes and the cliches of UFO sightings, Philip. You know, they'll tell you what you want to hear often, or what they expect you to know, or what their limited knowledge is of the subject.
Yeah.
So this case is remarkable in the fact that it just doesn't fit in anywhere. It's unbelievable.
It's biblical looking.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of sums it all up for me. I don't quite know what it means, but you've got something that's already extraordinary, and Linda herself in that description adds another level to it, or another layer. And like I said, when looking for things that are high strangeness, you couldn't get any more strange than Linda's encounter. And I mean that in the nicest possible way, of course, from a research point of view, because again, we know there's a lot of things that if not most things that gets reported to us, we've got an explanation sooner or later. But you can be as skeptical as you like, and I can be extremely skeptical, but I cannot even come close to suggesting anything that would help Linda come to terms with what she's seen that day. It's as simple as that.
I think I'm struck by some of the incredible cases in this book, Philip. There are some absolutely amazing stories from the 40s and 50s with witness drawings, sketches, statements that you and people that you've interviewed 30, 40 years after the events, and they are cast ironly resolute in their experience and what happened to them. And it just shows you that when we look at this subject, as I said in the introduction, for a lot of people looking at this from the outside, everything began in 1947. But clearly, when you start to look into things, there are so many reports of strange things in the skies prior to 1947. And as you were saying, a lot of people tend to think, I mean, I find this really odd these days, Philip, is that people tend to think that UFOs are simply a North American phenomenon. And yet, you know, we've got vast amounts of data about sightings from South America, Australia, Asia, Europe. And for anybody who just thinks that these things don't happen here, or we've had a handful of cases over the years, and everybody always focuses on the big ones here, when you look at your book, I think it just proves that this has been going on for so long. God knows what's happening, but some of these witnesses are close up. They have a variety of encounters. They meet entities. They see strange objects of varying descriptions. These are not the typical sightings. And I think that's one of the best reasons to buy this book, is if you want to understand a greater depth in what's been going on in this country and the things people have seen, there is far more and far more interesting cases for me than things like Rendlesham that often get put forward. And it's really good for me when you look at this, Philip, that we look at places like Wales and Scotland, which often get overlooked, even in the UK when we're talking about UFOs, because everybody seems to think that they don't happen. But obviously Malcolm's done so much great work in Scotland, and there's so many fantastic cases out of Wales as well, and obviously over Northern Ireland and the Republic as well. So it gives a real in-depth look at everything that's been going on here, and it's a fantastic collection of witnesses, stories and encounters, Philip. It's marvellous.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I think what it shows is also is that the subject is far more complex than we would perhaps want to imagine. At Flying the Express that I set up and run, of course, one of the things I've tried to do, Paul, is publish material from different parts of the world that we wouldn't possibly have seen before. I mean, I published UFO contacts in Brazil.
Yeah.
South America, as a landmass, probably has more, you know, high strangeness things reported than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
But I had a colleague from Brazil, right? And I'm hoping he'll do a follow-up. But I've also published material from Italy, from Japan, from Romania, from Poland. And there is some extraordinary encounters and cases in these books that, again, up until I published them, most of them will have never been known about, simply because of the language barrier, you know, rather than anything else. But here we don't have a language barrier, you know, in my book. And you were talking about pre-Kenneth Arnold cases. Again, I was very fortunate to meet a gentleman called John Warren in the 1980s. John's encounter was at a place called RAF Ludham in Norwich in May 1943. So right in the middle of the Second World War. John was in the, Mr. Warren was in the Royal Air Force. He worked at RAF Ludham. He was an armourer. So he would load the munitions onto the aircraft. He wasn't a flyer, but he was an armourer. He'd been to a local dance that night, and he'd missed the last train home. So he had to walk, and it was 12 miles. Now, he wasn't bothered about the 12 miles. He was more worried that he was going to be back late, and he'd get into trouble. So he set off. He came to the outskirts of the town. There's not on approach, up ahead is this green light. And as he gets closer, standing there is this entity, this humanoid. It's not moving. It's just stood there. On its chest, it has a box. And there is a green light coming out of the top of the box. And the humanoid's face, it makes it look as if it's got some kind of silly smirk on its face almost. I don't know if you ever did it when you were a kid and you got a torch and put it under your chin, and it distorts all your facial features. Well, this one, it looked like. Now, behind this thing on the grass verge was an object that Mr. Warren said looked like a bell tent, but it was illuminated. And then to the left were two more figures. And it terrified him. Again, it spooked the living daylights of him. He got back to his barracks. Luckily for him, one of his colleagues was up looking for him, you know, waiting for him coming home. And I think he let him in through a window. So he didn't... just to keep him out of trouble.
Yeah.
But he said, I told my colleague, and he said, he asked me not to publish it. Now, Mr. Warren will be long gone now. But one of the things he said to me, he said, Philip, had I been armed, I would have shot it.
Yeah.
Because I knew it wasn't one of us.
Mm.
So if it wasn't one of us, it must be one of them.
Yeah.
Them being the enemy, of course.
Mm.
And he said, I would have challenged it and shot it. And It's a bit almost, we mentioned him earlier with PC Alan Godfrey.
Yeah.
During his encounter, Alan was in his patrol car and stopped on the road. This thing was blocking the road in front of him, the UFO.
Yeah.
Alan said, if I'd had a stone, I could have thrown it at that thing and it would have gone clunk.
Yeah.
Thankfully, our police officers don't need to be armed. So it's a similar type of situation, you know.
Mm.
This being wartime, Mr. Warren said, if I'd have been armed, I would have shot it.
Yeah.
And I believe him. And I remember he reported this incident previously in the 60s. And I'd just done some local publicity where I lived in the 80s. And he saw me and he dropped me a line. So I only lived about a mile or so away from him. So I took the opportunity to go and speak to him in person.
Mm.
And he was, you know, shifting in his seat. He was, you know, wriggling when he's talking about this. And he had that far away look on his face. As if he can see it in his mind's eye. You know what I mean? It was a disturbing incident that he could still remember as clear today as he could all those years back.
Mm.
And like we said, it's one of those baffling little encounters. There's a drawing to go with it, and there's a copy of his letter and things like that. But pre-Kenneth Arnold, this is 1943, and it's just one into. And again, I was glad that I took the time and the trouble to go and sit in his house,
yeah,
and interview him in his front room. And you know, you get an idea about the person. And he was a smashing old chap. Again, he didn't talk much about his war exploits. Just, you know, he wanted to make sure that I didn't say he was a pilot or anything like that. He was an armorer.
Mm.
He armed the aircraft, and so that was his contribution to the war effort. And of course, much welcomed. Fascinating little account and great man to talk to as well. And it's just an example of pre-Kenneth Arnold, of course.
Brilliant. And the book's chock full of things like that, like you say, Philip. And there's some amazing cases, and we've touched on several today. So for anybody that wants to get hold of a copy of the book, follow your work and keep up to date with your upcoming publications and other books that they can get hold of. Philip, where's the best place for everybody to track you down and get hold of them, my friend?
Yeah, I've got a little blog. It's just flyingdiscpress.com. That's disc with a K. So it's flyingdiscpress.com. You know, the books go up on there. Recent interviews go on there as well. And little news, you know, any newspaper cutscenes or anything like that. Or just punch my name into Amazon. And you'll find it. We're all there. We're easy to find. I'm on Facebook, so I'm not hiding away anywhere. I'm not in a bunker in Pontefract. I'll give you an example, Paul. Some TV work I did went out last year,
mm.
And a local man emailed me and said, "Can I come and see you, Philip?" And he came and saw me, and he said, "I've got something from my wife's grandfather. It was deceased now," he said, "but back in the day, you'd been a mining engineer. All this area used to be mines."
Yep.
And he said, before he died, he self-wrote his own little memoirs. They weren't voluminous, you know, and the first half of the memoirs was about him as a child, where he grew up and his family. Second half was about engineering. This chap said the second half's really boring, you know. But in the first part, he used to live, when he was a youngster, he lived up near Manchester.
Mm.
And there is one chapter, and these were only printed for his family, printed them out himself.
Yeah.
And it's simply called The Encounter. And it's the largest chapter in the whole memoir. And it goes back to 1911, when him and his mate set off one morning to go to the local park. And they come across this thing. A cigar-shaped thing on the ground, and they go up to it. You know, there's a door opens that are humanoids there, almost Asian in appearance. They've got coloured clothes. They wear a kind of a turban. The children communicate, you know, they converse with them, and then off they go again. And, you know, this was 1911.
Mm.
And I was thinking about sticking it in the book, but the book was already finished. You know, I'd drawn the line in the sand and decided not to keep fiddling.
Yes.
But there's only a handful of people ever got to know about this simply because it was printed in his memoirs.
Mm.
And those were just for the family.
Mm.
So give you an idea of what else is lying around out there. There's lots more of this type of thing than we'd perhaps imagine.
And we can certainly say, with all seriousness, Philip, that certainly wasn't a helicopter.
Absolutely not. You know, it's a fascinating little account, Paul. It really is. And had this gentleman not seen me on TV, I would probably never have got to know about it.
Yeah. There must be hundreds of stories like that laying about out, as you say, Philip.
Absolutely.
Ah. So what else have you got coming up? Have you got any exciting new releases down the line for Flying Disc Press, my friend?
Yeah, well, as we know, June is it's the anniversary of the term flying saucer.
Yeah.
So 1st of June is a book out by an American author called Charles Lear, and it is simply called The Flying Saucer Investigators, and it goes back in time. It's more of a history book, looking at the early investigators from the flying saucer era, cases they worked on. And then, of course, July is the 75th anniversary of the Roswell crash.
Yep.
And I have a book by Kevin Randall, who's an American author, best-selling New York Times best-selling author,
yep.
I might add, one of the better-known Roswell researchers. I'll be publishing a book of his called Understanding Roswell. That'll be out July the 1st. Later in the year, I'll have a book from Jason Cleaves, UFO Encounters Up Close and Personal. And then we have a book, again, by Philip Kinsella and Brenda Butler. It's called Sky Crash Throughout Time.
Mm.
So a lot of it is about Brenda's investigations and encounters and sightings and other things that happened in and around the Rendlesham area. Nothing to do with the Rendlesham case at all. Totally separate of all that. Brenda was the first investigator of the Rendlesham case, of course.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit mention of, but it's about a whole host of other things that happened, nothing to do with the encounters that we all know and love, don't we, Paul?
Absolutely.
At Rendlesham. So I've got a list of things, and we're working on a number of other projects that hopefully will come to fruition before the year is out.
Fantastic. I look forward to them as well. And once again, it's a wonderful book, and I recommend everybody to get out and get a copy. Just primarily anybody who's got any interest in UFOs and ufology in the UK and beyond should definitely add this to their library, because I find it compelling. And like I say, the amount of cases that I've read in this book that I was unaware of or had very little knowledge, it's just expanded it. And I congratulate you for collecting these cases and bringing them to us, Philip.
Thank you, Paul. And like I say, if anyone wants a copy of the book, you'll find it on Amazon, and you will not be disappointed by its content, I can assure you.
Well, as always, my friend, I will put links to the show notes. And I will say thank you as always for your time, your consideration, and your wonderful conversation, my friend. You take care.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.